at the end of the day, I never got sued. Thank God. No one ever took me to court for saying, you know, holding up my faith.
Hello, welcome to Money Honestly. I'm Lionel Foster. Adrian Bracey was chief financial officer for the Arizona Cardinals, an NFL team now worth $5.5 billion. Today, she is a full-time advisor to one of the wealthier families in the country, helping guide their business and philanthropic operations. Billionaires listen closely when Adrian speaks, but her first and deepest loyalty is to someone with even more clout, God. Adrian has structured her exceedingly impressive career around conducting business and pursuing her religious convictions at the same time. Each reinforces the other. As you will hear, she knows the dangers of putting that aspect of her identity front and center, but decided long ago that it was worth the risk. Actually, given the strength of her convictions, I'm not sure she felt there was any choice in the matter. All right, Adrian, thanks for joining us at Money Honestly.
It's a pleasure, Lionel. Thank you for inviting me. I'm honored to be here.
Yeah. All right. So what's your money origin story?
Well, it goes back a long way. As a child, actually, I didn't really think about money until I really joined the church and gave my life to Christ. And that's when I learned about money. So that's where it starts.
Please say more about that. How is it that you only really started thinking about money in the church?
Well, I was 10 years old, and I just remember my pastor talking about the importance of tithing. And so at 10 years old, that's when I learned, oh, wow. So tithing is giving back to God, and God will bless me, not necessarily in money, but my blessings will come from me supporting the church. And so that's when I started. I was about 12 years old when I got my first job. And that was the first thing. I was so excited, like, oh my God, I have a little money. I have to give my dollar to the church and tithe. So that's where the money really clicked. And I have to say, that's been my practice since 12 years old, is giving first back to the church. And there are so many scriptures. I grew up in a spiritual environment, and that was important to our family, teaching us how to bless the church through tithing. So I guess that would be the start of my journey in budgeting, so to speak, my money, because I had to budget. So if I'm going to tithe out of $20, I had to learn to budget. So I started budgeting at such an early age. Maybe that's why I became an accountant and a CPA. Who knows?
Nice. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Miami, Florida, a neighborhood called Liberty City, infested with drugs and prostitution. Some of my siblings, unfortunately, got connected and tied up into that environment. I was fortunate because I was in the church. I knew God, so to speak, I had a relationship with God, put it that way. So I knew those things were not for me. And I feel 100% positive that's what drove me to be the person that I am today.
That's remarkable. I've spoken to maybe hundreds of people about something related to finances. This is the first time I heard that someone's number one priority from the time they started thinking about money was giving to the church. That speaks to a deep connection to your spirituality and to God. Could you say more about that?
Oh, absolutely. I would be thrilled. So again, like I said, I gave my life to Christ at age 10. And growing up, I was adopted by a family member because of that environment that I just described in Liberty City. it was the cousin actually who said, nope, we want you out of that environment. So they adopted me. My cousin and his wife adopted me, and they're the ones who really steered me toward my faith. And it was through my faith that I had the foundation. And I knew at an early age that I wanted to be successful. And so my biological family, there were six of us, three girls and three boys. I was the only one taken out of that environment. So I didn't grow up with the other five. I grew up with my cousin and his wife. They taught me my faith, first of all, and then giving to God, and then giving to others. So I grew up wanting to help people, even financially, but in any way possible. That was the foundation. And so I'm the same person now, you know, I don't know, 50 years later, or 55 years later, here I am still doing the same thing.
So I believe that you are essentially the same person. I buy that. But the difference between Adrian now and Adrian at age, say, 12, is that you've looked at the books and done the books for multi-million dollar corporations, and you've given all this money to nonprofit institutions. Does the forensic side of your mind, are they being good stewards, ever conflict with, well, I must tithe because that's in accordance with my faith?
You know, I've been so fortunate, and I can really talk about where I am this very moment in my career, working for a family that has a foundation, and the founder believes 100% that giving back is essential to his faith. And so that was really what drove me to work for the family that I'm working for now. It was faith. Faith was at the foundation of the relationship. And as I look back at a 12-year-old, I knew then that giving to the church, number one, was essential, and I truly believed it at 12 years old, was essential to my growth and my success. At 12 years old, I believe this was essential to my growth and my success in life. So at 12, I knew that. And the family that I work for had the same experience. And now he and his family, they're very successful. I'm not quite that financially successful, but I am successful in my own right. But I do believe for both of us, I think we both believe that the foundation is giving first to the church and then to those in need. In this case where I work, it's to nonprofits.
Yes. So first to the church, then to those in need, even or especially if you've been trusted with millions or billions of dollars.
Absolutely. And I'll even say hundreds of dollars, you know, I only had $20 at 12 years old, but I believe that it was my responsibility to help the church grow. There's some scriptures in the Bible to even say that, make disciples out of nations. Well, I need to help the church grow financially in order for them. At 12 years old, I knew this. We had a missionary ministry over in Africa. And so in order to help grow the church in Africa, you need money. You know, prayer is great. And of course, prayer, I pray today, I prayed at 12, I prayed. But sometimes actions can goes further with it. So prayer and then actions behind it.
It's easy for me to imagine you're perhaps giving above and beyond 1/10 of your income to the church and or other organizations. Is that right?
Oh, yes, absolutely. 100. Yes.
Could you talk about some of the things you facilitated? You mentioned this work abroad, but say more about that.
Sure. As I grew, I gave, of course, to the church. And then as I became an adult, graduated from college and so forth, then I started to give to nonprofits outside of my church, whether it's cancer, for breast cancer, or it could be a women's shelter. It could be a child's education center. I mean, there's so many in need. And today, I can tell you, the nonprofits, especially here in St. Louis, the economics of everything has increased in cost. So they're in need. So I've been giving to nonprofits since, oh gosh, since I graduated from college. That's just who I am, what I believe in.
You and I know what a family office is, but I would love for you to explain that for the audience.
Well, you know what's so ironic? Because what I have learned in this position 4 years, if you've seen one family office, you've seen one family office. And, you know, and I say that because a family office, typically, it's an organization, well, I'd call it, could be even a company, could be a private, LLC, however they set it up. So that's the business part. But usually there is a mission and a vision for the family office, just like there's a mission, typically should be a mission and a vision for a for-profit company. When you walk into a company, you'll see their mission statement on the wall. You know, we strive to provide customer service excellence, whatever. Usually a family office will have a mission and values, and that typically will drive their strategy, whether it's investment, and that investment could be to make money so that they can give more money. So that could be a strategy. The family office that I work for, the mission, of course, is around faith. And I don't want to go too much into that, but it's around faith and helping primarily the community in education, in the arts. It's a great pillar. There's now a part just added for animal stability, helping animals. I mean, so again, a family office typically will have a mission to do a certain good for the community, primarily. But then that's ours. There's other family offices where I've spoken to different family offices, and some of them, it's strictly investments. It's strictly just to build an endowment for whatever the purpose may be. It could be to invest in other businesses. It could be to give for nonprofits, but typically it's to help and to help either someone or business, but it's typically helping. What I love about the family office I work for is also about legacy, generational wealth, building that generational wealth for not only the family, but for the community that we live in. And that community in St. Louis is primarily Black and brown in the city of St. Louis, but also the foundation gives to the entire greater St. Louis. It's not just limited to the city.
I very much respect how tactfully you're talking about your work. You're sharing a lot about yourself. You want to protect the privacy of your employer. If we should not disclose this, I'll absolutely cut this part out. But is it okay to say that the principals in your family office are African-American, like you and me?
Well, yes. The principals are, and it's a joy to work for a family office that looks like me and has the same values and the same faith. I just feel so blessed to be in my position. Doesn't happen. I don't even know if it ever happens. So I'm just grateful to be where I am.
That's part of what I was picking up on. You said you don't know if it ever happens, that alignment of personal values, faith. In this case, race is another consideration. It's interesting because you could talk to plenty of other professionals at family offices, but it's possible you don't know any other Black people who are doing this work for very wealthy Black people.
I personally do not, and I'm sure they're out there. But I don't know if all of the wealthy Black people have a family office. Mm-hmm. You know, there are a lot of wealthy Blacks out in America, but a lot of them may not decide to have a foundation. They may give their their funds to a community foundation who then will manage their funds. So they don't necessarily have their own foundation because of whatever reason. They don't want the red tape, the regulations, the time. I mean, you have to have a staff. You have to have people to actually operate your foundation. It doesn't just happen. And so, and I get that. And there are quite a few of wealthy Blacks that go that route. And sometimes they join in with other, maybe another foundation, maybe not a community foundation, or they may have, in your case, maybe a financial advisor or so forth, that they, a private equity firm or whatever that they put their money into, or it could be just a regular mutual fund. It could be with Wells Fargo or Edward Jones or whomever, but our principal founder decided to create a family office.
And if memory serves, just to give folks a little bit of an idea of the structure, within the family office that you support, there's an investment side, making a financial return, and there's a section devoted to philanthropic and social causes. You're on the mission-driven side. Is that right?
Yes, but both. So in my role, I get to work with all the pillars of the organization.
Okay.
Or I would say go beyond the organ of the ecosystem of the principal, because there is the foundation piece. There's a venture capital piece. There is the investment piece. And then there's the Z2, which is generational two, the kids, the children, they have their own. And so in my role in the family office, I get to work with all of those across the board. So okay. I'm not limited to the philanthropic side. Of course, that's probably most of my work is working with that lane. I get to work with the foundation director, but also I get to see a lot of other things. It's almost like a quarterback where you see, you look out and you see, you have to be able to see all of the players, you know, where's the wide receiver? Where is the running back right here with me? And you have to be able to see the defense. Okay, who's coming at me? And of course, you know why I use that analogy, because I've worked in worked for the NFL for 18 years. So I always use football when it comes to my stories. But yeah. So yes, I like the role that I'm in. And when I went to college, I remember my counselor, I wanted to be a lawyer. And she said, well, you know, when I really looked at your SAT scores and your transcript, I think you should take accounting. And I said, well, accounting, I never really heard of accounting. She said, well, accounting is able to see the whole organization as a whole. It has to be able to understand the entire organization. And they're usually the first to know when the organization is going to go out of business. And I thought, whoa, that's what I want. And then she said, an accountant, CPA, typically will never be without a job. So that put cherry on ice for me. And so when she said that, I thought, okay, I'm going to go into accounting, finance accounting.
What did you do in the NFL?
I was actually fortunate to work for three NFL teams. I started with the Miami Dolphins for 4 years as controller, and then I was promoted to VP of finance, then moved to St. Louis to work for the St. Louis Rams. They had just moved from LA to St. Louis, and I became their VP of finance for 12 years. And then I just needed something different. So I heard about the CFO for the Arizona Cardinals football team retiree. So I sent my resume to Arizona, to the Cardinals, and I was hired there for their CFO role. And then after that, I decided, okay, Laura, I just feel calling, and it's not in football. 18 years was great. I have no complaints. But then the Lord opened up the door for me to move back to St. Louis and become the CEO of the YWCA here in St. Louis, which was my calling, helping women and girls.
So I'm hearing how important faith is to you. You have some deeply held values. And then I think about some of the headlines that can come out about owners
of major American sports franchises. So, for example, right now, there's this nonsense with the LA Clippers, which I imagine you've heard about. Yeah, it looks like you have.
Yeah.
So was that a challenge for you? And again, you, when it makes the headlines, you're hearing outlier situations, tomfoolery, financial misfeasance, perhaps. But did you ever feel conflicted working within the NFL?
You know, I was fortunate, and I've seen some financial mishaps within my roles. You know, the first was when I went to work for the Miami Dolphins. You know, I'm from Miami, so for me, that was like a dream job. Then I found out that the family, unfortunately, had to pay estate taxes because of the death of the founder, and they were not able to. So they had to sell the team. And that really hurt because I really loved that family. However, financially, they didn't prepare. And it's so important for people to prepare for estate planning. So that was my first experience of, whoa, this is a real financial mishap here. Fortunately, they sold the team to someone that became a mentor. His name was Wayne Huizinga, who at that time owned Blockbuster, and he had also owned Waste Management. And so he purchased the Dolphins and the stadium, and I learned a lot from him. And then I left there and moved to the Rams. At the Rams, I was very fortunate. They were very astute with finances, so we didn't have any mishaps. And when Georgia, the owner, passed away, Stan Kroenke was able to move right in. And then working for the Arizona Cardinals, they did very well financially, so there were no embarrassing moments there. I mean, they had other issues, but it wasn't financial.
I think some people might be envious of the amount of wealth they hear among families that own major sports franchises, but you just mentioned a very wealthy family that had a bill come due that they could not pay.
Correct. Yeah.
Wow.
And it's real, especially back in the 90s when I was working in the NFL, because a lot of teams were not, people thought that they had all this money. People thought that they were like the Dallas Cowboys bank account with all this money. But one difference I can say, and I'm sure there are many, the Cowboys had a lot of different streams of revenue coming in. When, you know, when you have your, you have a store that's selling paraphernalia. I mean, just a whole lot of different avenues. And it depends on how they structured the contract, whether or not they received some of the concessions money, some of the food and beverage money they may or may not have. But when you have to pay the players and the coaches, and the staff get a little something, but primarily the players and the coaches, your net profit is not a whole lot if you don't have other revenue streams coming in. If you only have your gate income, just money from your ticket sales, you could be in some serious trouble. But fortunately, though, however, the NFL did structure back then, I don't know what it is today, the TV revenue. So that brought in money equally to all the teams. So there wasn't one team to get $50 billion and another one get $5 billion. I'm sorry, million, you know, whatever. That helped a lot of the struggling teams. So, yeah, so there are a lot of teams. And I just told you, you know, the Miami Dolphins, where they don't make a whole lot of money and people think they do. And unfortunately, you know, a lot of times they had to sell.
And there's a huge difference between liquid and illiquid assets.
Oh, absolutely. And, yeah. And not just in sports, that's in any business. You know, so liquid assets is great to have. A lot of wealthy people may have it in real estate, you know, so the money, they may be a millionaire, but it's not liquid. It's tied up in your real estate. But on your balance sheet, it looks great.
Adrian, this is the most candid conversation I've had in many years that involve both business and faith. Mm. And in my world, most people avoid mixing those things. You obviously do not. Is that difficult sometimes?
you know, it, over my career, I can say yes, there were situations where it was difficult. But at the end of the day, I was respected for it. You know, at the end of the day. Now, earlier in the day, I may not have been. I had some bumps and some bruises. But at the end, I was respected. I was never, or a couple of times I've had someone to say, well, we really can't do that because it's spiritual. But overall, at the Rams, you know, I started a women's Bible study. And that's the fortunate thing. In the NSL, however, spirituality is welcomed. It wasn't something we had to shy away from. It was something that was okay to do. The YWCA, although it's Young Women's Christian Association, it's not a faith-based organization. So whenever you receive federal funding, we were not able to voice our faith in public. And that was very, very hard. And I remember when I first started, the PR person, she said, Adrienne, you know, you really can't talk about God in public because we're not a faith-based organization and we get federal funds. So I had to talk around it. But in my staff meetings, I made it perfectly clear. And in the beginning, when I started, you know, in 12 years, my first couple of years, I would say, you know, we're going to have prayer. And if it's offensive to anyone, please, at this moment, please feel free to step out because we are going to pray. And then a couple of people said, Adrienne, I don't know if you should say that because if someone gets up, they're going to feel kind of embarrassed. So I stopped. I just said, okay, we're going to have prayer. And I just went on with the prayer. And so that was very awkward in the beginning. But at the end of the day, I never got sued. Thank God. No one ever took me to court for saying, you know, holding up my faith.
It sounds like that was on your mind or maybe the back of your mind for some years.
It was because the PR person told me when I started, you've got to be careful because you don't, as a CEO, you don't want people to feel like they're being mandated to have faith. She said it a different way, but that's basically what it was. As a CEO, you know, just you've got to make it voluntary. You can volunteer to be a part of the Bible study or not Bible study of the prayer or not, but the staff 99.9 would send me emails, would grab me after the meetings and say, Miss Bracey, thank you so much for your prayers. It was a predominantly Black staff and they were having issues and my prayers were about issues. It wasn't about give your life to God right now. It wasn't about hell and fire like I grew up. When I grew up, it was. It was about real life prayer, you know? And so, yeah. So I felt like I drew people in versus having them run away.
I definitely want to touch on that because a potential downside is that you had to think about whether or not you would be pursued. But
I know, yeah.
Another way to frame your sharing your faith is that in the workplace, you were very transparent about who you were, what counts to you, how much you care about people, the things you care about that are even bigger than a paycheck. And I think when you make yourself that available and that transparent, that really resonates with people.
It really did. I actually had people cry to me. Just this week, I go out and at a restaurant this week. I mean, it happens all the time. But this week in particular, a young lady just having breakfast, Miss Bracey, oh my God, I remember you. Now, of course, I don't remember her, but, you know, I always make people feel like I remember them. I always do. And she said, just thank you so much for all you did for us at the Y, because it went beyond a paycheck, like you said. It was encouragement. It was faith with real life situations, because half of the staff, maybe more than half, they were having the same struggles as the clients. So wow. I felt that. I knew that. And encouraging them, we couldn't pay them a whole lot, but we can give them encouragement, days off in place of money, because for a lot of them, they needed time to take care of their sick children. And so there are just different ways we were able to give back to our staff other than money, because we just didn't have the money to give those big raises like a corporation. But we gave them encouragement and love and mental health days. So, yeah.
Part of what you're describing is how you were a trusted advisor to people, say, on the lower end of the socioeconomic stratum. You're now a trusted advisor for someone at the very top of the socioeconomic stratum. So people just come to you with issues. How do you feel about that, Adrian?
I feel like that's my whole life. Like, that's what I've been doing. Like, all my life, I've had people come to me with issues, and I've always enjoyed helping them. It's my life. It's my story. It's who I am. And like you said, now I'm in a whole different environment, and helping a family that loves the Lord is the best thing that could happen. I mean, I've helped those, even my own family, even to this day, who don't have. I have family members who are struggling financially and you name it, health-wise and so on. But then to be able to help a family that maybe just need my advice. And I remember when I first took the job 4 years ago, you know, I had just retired from the YWCA as the CEO for 12 years. And I just was finishing up writing my book, and I had taken two courses to become certified as an executive leadership coach. And so I had already started planning my next journey, my career journey, which was to have my consulting and consult with some nonprofits and sell my book and be an executive leadership coach. And the search firm came after me and said, "Hey, we just read that you're retiring. What are you going to do?" I said, "Well, actually, I'm going to pray about it." And they said, "Wow, will you pray about this opportunity that we have? We want to talk to you about." And I'm like, "No, I'm okay, but I'm already thinking about my job, what I'm going to do, my career, my book. I've got to sell my book." Well, the bottom line is that by the time I got to the owner, the principal of the family, and interviewed with him, and I said, "Well, you know, I would definitely like to consider the position, but I would like to still keep my consulting because I really love coaching women. I just love coaching." And he said to me, "Oh, don't worry. You're going to have plenty of time to coach me. I promise you." And so I thought that was so awesome. I thought, "Oh my God, this is so awesome." So to be in this position as not a coach, but maybe an advisor. So yes, come full circle. And I feel that God is using me to be able to give the gifts that he has given me to others. And that is, whether it's the financial piece of it, whether it's teaching women how to start a budget, which I love doing, because a lot of people don't live on budgets. They just don't even realize how much money that goes in and out. And so to be able to help women, you know, I was 26 years old when I made my very first investment into the stock market, 26 years old, and I still have that account. And that is about 39 years ago, but I still have,
Do you still have that stock?
I still have that same. Oh my God. Yeah. It was, yeah. It's grown.
So you're a buy and hold kind of investor.
I am. I'm a buy and hold because I don't need it. You know, I have another account where I need it. So that one is a little different, but if it's stock that I mean, if it's just money, I have this extra money at 26 years old. It was $300 that I opened up my investment account with Oppenheimer at the time. I still have the same financial advisor, the same person.
Wow. I'm curious, you're an advisor to a wealthy family. You're also an accountant, but we see that sometimes doctors don't always take their own medicine. I bet you do. So my question is, could you say a little bit about, at a high level, how you structure your estate, your own financial affairs, especially since you've seen some pretty difficult situations that you've maybe had to help other people through?
Yes, that's a good question. Because I majored in accounting, growing up with budgets as a little girl, that is passionate to me. So I do take my own medicine. so to speak. I'm very, and not that I'm conservative or frugal with my money. I feel like I'm just smart with it for the most part. I mean, there are times when I want to buy something, but I save for it. So estate planning for me is really key because my husband and I, we do have assets. And you're right. You know, the Miami Dolphins was my first experience of seeing someone lose something so great. And it was part of their family for all these years. And so I thought then, okay, wow, that was a lesson for me. So I have made sure that I've had my will when I was single, because it depends on the state you live in. If you die without a will, everything can go to the state, and then your family have to go through probate and try to, and get that back, and just a whole lot of red tape. And when my grandmother died at 79 years old, third grade education, she had a suitcase with everything. I was the executor. Everything was laid out. And I was only 27 years old, but she had her, even her obituary was already done. She had a will. She had her CDs with each name, person, and all I had to do was execute it. And so I've been very fortunate to have role models. My grandmother was my role model. So yes, my husband and I, we do make sure we have our, you know, our trust. Everything is laid out. Even you, people don't like to talk about this, but I'm from Miami, but I live in St. Louis. So even at my death, I would like to have a memorial in St. Louis, but I want to be buried in Miami. So just thinking about things like that, a lot of people don't, because it's not a great subject to talk about, but it's important that families put together, even if it's $1,000, it doesn't matter how much you have in the bank. You want to make sure that that $1,000 goes to the right person. Who do you want it to go to? People think, I don't have a whole lot, so I'm not going to worry about it. Well, you know what? You should, if it's something that's important to you. It could be whatever, a purse, whatever, that you want to go to your great-granddaughter, whatever. Write it down. Let your family know the desires of your heart before you pass, and then they have to stress out trying to figure out, oh, what does she want? I don't know. Who knows? That's not fair to them as well.
I was just thinking as you were saying that the planning you're doing is such a service to the people you love after you're gone.
Absolutely. It is. I mean, your death is already sad and heartbreaking. Now you want them to go and try to dig out all the stuff that you have, and you didn't tell them what you want and how you want it. You know, I just believe that I love my family enough not to put them through that.
As we wrap, is your coaching practice still active?
My coaching practice is active, but I have put it on hold. I only have one client now because she won't go away. And I love her dearly, but I've decided that it's just time for me to kind of step back and just be still. So that's what I've been praying. And God just showed me, just slow down, stop. So right now I'm just doing my family office work and my one client, and I may pick up in about a year or less. That's what I'm feeling in my spirit. Yeah.
And what's the name of your book?
It's called Halftime. Learn to pivot as a leader and identify your next step. And of course, Halftime is because of NFL experience.
Was there something I did not ask about that you would also like to share?
Oh, thank you for asking. Do you hit everything out? The ballpark. My faith is the biggest thing. And so I think that came across very clear.
All right. Fantastic. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
Music for Money Honestly is courtesy of bassist, composer, and band leader Chris Funn. It's his song Wish from the album Corner Store. Money Honestly has a newsletter. You can sign up for it at lionelfoster.com.